This Writers' Centre Norwich podcast is brought to you from the City of Literature programme at Norfolk and Norwich Festival 2016.
The last time I fell apart was in my 40s when my wife stopped loving me. The problem was Dawn didn't understand the mathematics of us. I tried to explain it to her for 10 years or more, and she just stopped listening. My last throw of the dice had been Dr. Zeman, the inspirational mathematics guru, who too believed in relating human behaviour to numbers. He built a little machine to explain all the complications of catastrophe in a way so simple, I thought even Dawn with her poor maths would understand. See how I was right and fall in love with me all over again. I imagined he'd see another numbers chap in trouble and take his little machine down from its shelf. No more than elastic bands and a wheel nailed to plywood. My wife rolled her eyes as Dr. Zeman showed how our moods stretch out, how at a certain point the slightest shift in the machinery can send us spinning. He drew arrows with a red felt pen on a sheet of paper, talked about displacement and its dependency on the load while he twisted it in his hands. And whichever way he looked at it, he said, smiling, continuous causes are dividing you. I'm afraid you have bifurcated. And the discontinuous effect is that you are here on the fold above the cusp of catastrophe where I have written growl. She once loved me so much she was inconsolable at the thought of being away from me even for a short while before we married. Had gazed through the rear window of her parents' red Ford Cortina, eyes bleary with tears as they drove away. I'd wanted Dr. Zeman to throw that Ford Cortina into reverse and us into each other's arms at the curbside to exactly that moment. I held tight for 10 years. I held tight not for the kids. I held tight so no one need know. I held tight for the ache. I held tight and it was a lonely boat. And divorce is only too common, nothing special. No one's going to admire you for coming through it. No one thinks you're blameless, Martin. No one's saying, oh, poor, poor man, his wife wants to get away from him. The last time I faced such an uncertain future, I was a gauntless, pimply youth. It's a cruel irony that the male of our species is at his least attractive when he's most desperate for love. At least as a gauntless youth, I had pop songs telling me to be whatever I want to be, or at least keeping me company while love or the lack of it tore me apart. In my 40s, no one was telling me I could touch the sky. The person appraising my qualities knew me better than anyone had ever known me and wasn't speaking in those terms. Was busy trying to get some sense of her own self back at last. She bought me a Jack Kerouac on the road t-shirt. The woman knows how to drop her head. The year was 2001, a new millennium, and God, I needed some space and odyssey. California, where a man might plant his feet at the end of the world stand in the shadow of a giant redwood to face the might of the biggest blue ocean as it hurled itself against the ragged edge of land. California, where a middle-aged man might hire an open-top sports car and not be mocked. I had my ticket, my rough guide, my travel insurance and antihistamines. I was on the road, man, woo-wee. And riding shotgun, my boy Sean, a better-looking, looser-limbed, earlier version of myself, how I used to look. And before the trip, we'd been going through a box of old photographs together when Sean hesitated over this one of me as a kid with a chimney sweep in Poland. He shook his head as if he couldn't puzzle it out, said, "I don't remember that being taken." Oh, I could have imprinted a false memory right then. Lived again through him. I was face to face with my own mortality. This was Highway 1. We put down the top, cranked up the music and span the wheels. And the Pacific Coast Highway twisted and bucked ahead of us. We put our faith in 3 millimetres of tyre tread and tarmac, kept true to the white line as we gunned our way past the lofty majesty of Big Sur's granite cliffs, seeing nothing but a black grey wall of fog. In our wake, just fumes and dust. We swung inland towards Yosemite's smouldering horizon and scorched trees. El Capitan's face turned to the last of the sun. I was pretty raw, and Sean was the last person I could talk to about it. The radio played only easy listening Californian soft rock or the sweet Lord Jesus. We hiked to the top of a mountain and swam in an emerald lake. Not much phase, Sean, growing up. Even the teenage years were fairly easy. As long as we kept the fridge stocked, he just got on with the business of gangling. Did not even have the decency to be awkward around girls. They'd turn up at the front door and off they'd go together as if it was the most natural thing in the world. And like most teenagers, he could be a smart ass. Once, after school, I quizzed him about his day and got nothing but adolescent grunts in response. "Do you know any words with more than one syllable?" I asked. He looked me square in the eye and said, "Wanker." But he hadn't seen the road trip as revenge, had he? A tramp. Until it was too late. Until he found himself in a two-seater car for 3 weeks with a man who'd read a lot of books and listened to a lot of records. Sean gazed through the windscreen at the endless highway, the desolate Californian prairie as blank as a page. This boy was gonna get an education. I was Tom Joad from the Grapes of Wrath, getting out the Dust Bowl to find my soul. I was Woody Guthrie, bound for glory in a boxcar. I was Sal Paradise, on the road, ready to burn, burn, burn. I was the Grateful Dead. I told Sean that John Steinbeck had been my hero and that I'd read all of his books by the time I was his age. I had him photograph me outside Steinbeck's boyhood home in Monterey, and we walked along Cannery Row together, where there were still vacant lots, just like in the book. "Look, Sean, that's where Doc might have spoken his wisdom to Mac and the boys as they guzzled their quart of old tennis shoe whiskey." Sean said he needed a drink, and he was hungry. And a 16-year-old lad isn't prepared to wait even for a moment when he needs to eat, which is often. I had to settle for a sardine tin lid from the souvenir shop, and we headed to the harbour for clam chowder out of sourdough bowls with all the other tourists. While we ate, I told him about my childhood for the first time, the violent death of my mother when I was 9, about being abandoned and ending up in care separated from my sisters, that books became my escape and my constant, how I left school at 15 and headed into the world with the grapes of wrath and everything else I owned in a small Adidas hold-up. In San Francisco, we bought Sean Blaze from Skates on Hate, K2250s. He was hair-gelled and snake-tipped, wrap-around Ray-Banned and too cool for school, skimmed the corner of Hate and Asprey too fast for me to inform him that he had just gone past what had been Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead's front door. In 1967, the Summer of Love, the epicentre of the counterculture revolution where hippies flocked with flowers in their hair for peace, love and understanding. He was flying across the street to the open space of Golden Gate Park. They sang about freedom, I shouted after him. The day before we flew back, I headed down to the City Lights bookstore, Lawrence Ferling Getty's Cathedral to the Beat Generation, and ever since a flickering light bulb to the moth-eaten self-involved. I bought a massive pile of beautiful Black Sparrow Press Bukowski books, taking me well over my personal baggage limit. I wasn't the first bloke to turn to Bukowski for bravado or to romanticise my situation by hiding my broken heart and V-neck sweater under a leather jacket. Even if under that jacket, under that sweater, I was disappearing to a dot. Middle-aged men are the easiest social group to generate empathy for. We are the loudest voice in the room. Seemingly there's nothing we can't explain. It's happening to you right now. On that last day though, in the bookshop, I quietly took down this little pocket series copy of Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and by that grand central bookcase, I let Allen Ginsberg do the talking. I let him explore the avenues of my mind.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night.
Howl was first published in 1956, which is the year I was born. And in that bookshop on that day, I'd have crawled back to the comforting beat of the womb for a bit of primal therapy if I could have. The visceral energy of Howl pierced me. I wanted to cry out, I am 5,000 miles from home and lost. Instead, I took the notebook from the back pocket of my faded jeans and wrote myself back across an ocean and nearly half a century to the northwest of England of my boyhood. I saw the best suits of my parents' generation destroyed by poor tailoring, synthetic fibres and hysterical lapels, dragging their shopping down the high streets of Albion in Packamacs with hairdos under air nets and head scarves. Brill cream deaded husbands burning pipe tobacco in walnut bowls and inhaling through the clenched teeth of repressed ardour. Who feared the windrush down the negro streets of Victoriana, blowing the sounds and smells that threatened the unfamiliar and didn't even know Elvis Presley existed yet? Who got drunk on homemade egg flip at Christmas and sang the old songs round the piano while their kids were happy with a tangerine or dinky toy? Who saved so that one day they might have a little car and be saluted by the AA man as they drove by? Who were all the time boiling vegetables to eat with Spam while listening to the radio Grand Val singing hot with family favourites? And after Sprouts, there was much binding in the marsh until Billy Cotton cried out, "Wakey, wakey!" And Bandstand glowed out in the deathly grey of cathode rays. Who on Fridays went dancing up the club in sixpence a week Montague Burton suits and crammed into 18-hour girdles and mail-order dresses with their blue hair piled on top, but just too soon to have ever been teenagers. Who tripped out to Skegness, Vimto fuels to shine under Billy Butlin's neon. Our true intent is all for your delight, while being served brown ale by lasses from Doncaster in grass skirts under plastic palm trees in the Beachcomber Bar. Who never used their front room but kept it pure in the anti-macassars pressed for visits by doctors or vicars or teachers for tin salmon, tin pears and tin milk, and always polished their front steps and never ran out of string. Who knew their place and never thought the universities were for the likes of them, but prayed for office jobs for their children and stood for God Save the Queen at the Empire and said how wonderful their policemen were and fought in the war for the likes of you, who had more words for toilet than the Inuit have for snow and put their teeth in jars and slept in their vests under candlewick counterpanes with dreams of winning the pools and bungalows in Cheshire with inside loos and labour-saving devices, who at dawn trod into brown slippers onto coal brown linoleum and could only face the day through the sweet brown haze of 100 cups of tea and 20 Caxton full strength. In camera lucida, Roland Barthes, the French theorist, contemplates a photograph of his beloved mother from when she was a young girl. It's a picture he only discovered after her death and taken before he was born. And he realised that her death implied his own, in much the same way that I realised that Sean mistaking himself for me as a kid implied my mortality. Barthes observed this fundamental truth. All photographs are memento mori. To take a photograph is to participate in another person's mortality, vulnerability, mutability. Precisely by slicing out this moment and freezing it, all photographs testify to time's relentless melt. My father bought me a Del Monte twin lens reflex, a German camera from the 50s. Everything was murky on the ground glass and moved in the opposite direction to what you'd expect. The soft tick of the shutter kept time. My mother loves the camera and it loves her back. She holds baking straight from the oven under its nose. Laughs for it when she's smoking and drinking, blows it kisses, parades each new dress for it, closes her beautiful mascara eyes and sleeps for it. I conjure her in the dark room, wash away the silver, fix her, make her permanent. Barthes' aim was to explore photography for sentimental reasons, not as a question but as a wound. He used the Latin term punctum to describe that which pierces through our consciousness to evoke emotion, pleasure, and pain. Camera is an eye, is a mouth, is sprung blades snapping shut, is your dad in a suit, is a dark little factory, is prepared to lie, is full of regrets, is better behaved on Sundays, is an empty bed in a room, accepts our surrender, is carefully placed, is elsewhere, is proof of the loss. They fuck you up, your kids. They may not mean to, but they do. They take all the faults you have and throw them back twice as hard at you. But they will fuck up in their turn in fashionable clothes that look good now, but in years to come in a photograph album will return to shame and haunt them. Children return lover's guilt to parents that deepens like crap on a bedroom floor. Move them on as early as you can. Don't ever try for any more. On the 9th of June, 1983, the sun rose and spoke to me in person about my firstborn, my tomorrow's child. Liverpool, my beautiful blazing city of birth, told her last joke and slipped her moorings. The sun scorched her and all the other gap-toothed towns. The sun scorched the 3 million bare necks of the head hung jobless. Tomorrow, my darling, yuppies will pour themselves champagne drunk from their grinning towers. The day will shine for you, not them in their dressed-down Friday chinos. The day will shine for you. Pay no heed to that woman waving her claw from an upstairs window. The matron had been quite clear I was to go home and wait for the phone to ring. I wasn't going to miss the birth of my first child. At 5 a.m. I abandoned the sofa and depressing election results and was back there. A pissy nurse shoved me in an empty waiting room and didn't let me out until 9 o'clock. Only then was I able to entertain and distract Dawn from her labour pains by wearing the grey cardboard sit bowl as a hat. Amy was born at 11:35 after what may have been the longest 2.5 hours of Dawn's life. She arrived with a slick of auburn hair. I whispered to Dawn, "She is perfect." We didn't recognise the sudden kerfuffle in the delivery room as anything unusual. Dawn was exhausted and needed to sleep. A nurse whisked Amy away, and I went to town for a celebration full English breakfast. On my return, I was ambushed in the stairwell and hurried to the special care baby unit, where a doctor blurted out that Amy had Down syndrome. The news knocked me into a chair, had me woozy in the stifling warmth of that room. While my sweater was half over my head, the doctor explained, "This means she's a Mongol," and asked if I wanted him to tell Dawn. I said I knew what Down syndrome was and it was my job to tell her. I walked down that corridor, wishing it different, wishing yesterday to be waiting the other side of the swing doors with its hopes and dreams. We'd got pregnant easily. I'd just been promoted and we'd spent spring decorating the first house of our very own. We were so young and adorable, the Beverly Building Society manager had tied our mortgage deeds with a pink ribbon. Our life was good. We sang along to Randy Newman in the car. Oh, they're so nice. What's going to happen to them? Dawn was sat up, glowing and happy on the high hospital bed. I told her as abruptly as the doctor told me. And we did allow ourselves some time for weeping before we burst out laughing and sang our song together. At the first checkup, that doctor didn't get up from behind his desk to look at Amy, nor did he introduce the two women, writing down everything we said. The doctor explained, "This means she's a Mongol, means mental retardation, means things will never be the same for you again, means multiple malformations, a single palm crease, lacks muscle tone, an extra 21st chromosome, epicanthal folds on her eyes, a tongue too long and loose in her mouth, a murmuring holy heart. This means she's a Mongol. The bell of a stethoscope, the sound of a flood, which meant all we could do was love her, which meant all that she did was glorious and skewed, which meant we were made for each other." Two years later, Sean slipped into the world with no fuss at all, which is his way. And there we were, a family, a mother and son, a father and daughter, an equality as balanced as an equation. Only it just takes something as small as a chromosome, invisible to the human eye, to tip equilibrium onto its side. This means she's a Mongol. This means she is different. This means she is wrong. In a family, there are relationships at play. A measurable space between values. What is a norm? The orbital limits of members may differ widely, making comparisons unstable. This is often the case when the dynamics of it are chaotic. By studying the trajectory of one member, difficulties arise. Some may wander erratically, become lost or vulnerable. The behaviour of one affects the behaviour of others. Biology and magic have a role to play. It may well separate into two parts. One that converges to the orbit, another that diverges from the orbit. Some are too complicated to be understood. A circle map may be used to study the behaviour of a beating heart. Families are like a free spinning wheel coupled to a small motor with string. The flow of water in a pipe. The swing of a pendulum, footprints in the snow, the number of fish each springtime in a lake. When our family broke, when it bifurcated, Sean went with his mum, Amy stayed with me. It did not even need discussing. This was how, over time, the family had shifted inside itself, recalibrated to 31 decimal places, how the equation functioned. And Emmy didn't grow up to be a stereotypical hug-loving Downs, but something of a curmudgeon. We believe she may even have irritable Down syndrome. She has always called me Martin and bossed me about, something she can only have got from her mother. My role was clear. I was the stooge, her psychic. And it was happy and uncomplicated as long as I did do as I'm told. Next line, please.
She was never going to grow up.
Sorry?
She was never going to grow up.
She was never going to grow up. She was never going to grow up to criticise my parenting skills or call me a wanker. She was never going to grow up. She was the perfect daddy's girl. And as the daughter of a photographer, she knows how to strike a pose. Amy was taking selfies years before mobile phone cameras, before digital even. Films will be returned by True Print with the occasional surprise. She knows what to do when she sees a camera. Here she is, photobombing a cinema birthday treat. We have no idea who these people are. And yet they let her into their picture with something close to joy. Amy has never recognised social boundaries. She rolls a loaded dice and knows it. And I like to think that when they look back at their picture, the punctum, the thing that pierces them and gives them pleasure, will be the dance girl they didn't know, who decided to be in their picture, and how they just let her. When photographing your daughter, remember, this is your past you are making, so it's all right to be a little sentimental, to arrange things just so. Go to her cave of torn wallpaper, patched with her own thrown shadows. Her entourage will do as bidden. If Mickey Mouse casts a cloud, be patient. All things pass, and you are the bringer of light. Amy will present herself emphatic and proud when she is good and ready. This is a splinter of time pressed to your heart, the truth to keep and the wound. And this is the picture both Dawn and I have framed on our walls, our favourite, how we choose to see her. Only, I also pressed the shutter when Mickey was casting his cloud, and that is the picture neither of us can bear to look at, so we keep it in a box. Sorry, I need another line.
Only each time.
Hold on a minute.
Only each time we look at the same picture.
Come round back this way. Right. Only each time we look at the framed picture, we can't help but think of the terrible picture and have to tell ourselves that she has always been happy with her own company. At Sean's sixth birthday party, kids rampaged about the house while Amy sat ignored with everything too fast about her. And of course, this made both Dawn and I unhappy, but she did seem to have the friends she needed by pushing a video cassette, or now a DVD, into the machine. This is no passive activity, it's interactive and very noisy. She has the time of her life. And oh, the level of excitement when we scale things up with our first trip to the cinema. The lights went down. The big screen came to life. Wow! Martin, big video! Hit the walls of that auditorium and echoed back as laughter. And I'm afraid the big video is every bit as interactive as watching her. Oh, yes. And at the end of the film, she bustles her way to the front of the cinema to dance her strange spinning dance to the big finale song as I stand sheepishly by and everybody else files out. Only one time, another little girl joined in, and then more and more children, until there was this magical mosh pit of wild toddlers whirling about her. And I did just keep taking her to see Chicken Run because it was so much fun watching her watch. And when we got home, she would reenact scenes. Once she came downstairs, having dressed herself up as Mrs. Tweedy, the bad lady who made the chicken pies. These are our happy, immersive, dark hours. Amy has lived through a golden age of children's cinema, often with a Randy Newman soundtrack to sing along to. At home, she rewinds and replays the same short scenes dozens of times, getting more and more vocal with each play. Her focus hones itself down to a single character, and he, it's always a he, becomes an obsession that lasts for years, and the seas will not part them. While they are with her, she takes their name as her own and dresses like them. It's not enough to love them. She must climb into their skins and wear them like pajamas. It's Fireman Sam just now, has been for a couple of years. She wanders that pyromaniacal valley town with matches in her backpack. She'll smoke out the hero inside herself, hit rewind again and again. Can't get enough of his tune or his merchandise until 6 p.m. when she turns Sam off for Channel 4, taps her fingertips together and is Mr. Charles Montgomery Burns. She has his shaky walk down pat, mimics his villainous laugh while Sam pretends to polish his axe. He knows it's not the last Lothario, but the next. Some bright new kid, all pixels on the big screen at the multiplex. A cheap toy with her Big Mac. Then it's shopping for DVDs, utility belts and action figures, and his heart's a stone. While out west, Woody tips back his hat, squints through the haze of all the years since Shaggy turned up in his mystery machine and she began to dress in brown and green, left her sheriff badge to tarnish. But Woody was first and best and bides his time. Toy Stories 2 and 3 went by, but he's pretty sure when 4 comes out, she'll mosey on into town in a cowskin waistcoat, shout, "Yee-haw, Woody," as though she's never been gone. Of course, I prefer the cartoons to real-life boys, something she's never shown the slightest interest in. I used to ask her who she loved, and she would always start with a current cartoon squeeze and work her way through her back catalogue, until eventually, with some prompting, she would get to me. The first actual human on the list. Sometimes I came before the dog. Mostly I came after the dog, and I've long since stopped asking. And we always knew the day was going to come for a holy murmuring heart to be fixed. Regular hospital appointments reminded us. So when she was 12, we did a family photo session as insurance against the loss, packed Sean off to his grandparents to be spoilt and headed to Great Ormond Street. Amy had seen enough of hospitals to accept what was happening, with all the good grace that someone with irritable Down syndrome could muster. And it all went really well. We were to be home within the week. Then, a couple of mornings later, we walked into a room and she was swollen, shining with sweat, struggling for breath. Her eyes were full of terror and fixed on us. These were the days when the MRSA bug first rampaged through our hospitals. 5 more times she drifted through those swing doors. Each time we were more terrified that the last time we would hold her would be for the needle to go in. That night we sat on the hospital steps, smoke, time measured in cigarette smoke. The Bloomsbury moon watching over us as Amy's chest was prized apart again for the infection to be drained away. The battle was happening beyond our reach. We were unarmed and hollowed out. The Canadian surgeon came and found us on his way home. He had to say our names more than once to bring us back. He was movie star handsome, reached down and helped us to our feet. He said this: "I have held her heart in my hand and it's fine. You are good people." Sweet curmudgeon, moon-faced child, moon at the top of the stairs, cheese thief and comical saint, sternum split like wood, his open palm, its line of fortune, your yarn-stitched heart, your hands of fire, their simian crease, cuttle bone moon, mass moon, moon adrift, the hauled up ladder, a dinosaur's spine. Sea of vapours, serpent sea of crises, ocean of storms, sea of cold, sea that has become known. Come on home, sliver of moon, wild-eyed moon, rattle of stones, moon of rain, moon of love. We're good people, glimmer of moon, and you're our moon. Shine down, moon, as though nothing were amiss. She was very shaky for a good few months. Friends who knew and loved the robustious Amy simply burst into tears when they first saw how fragile she was. But she got her strength back, and before we knew it, she was 17. And college took her. Even daddy's girls have to leave home one day, I suppose. Every 3 or 4 weeks, I would go and collect her for a visit. Amy would parade me from room to room, interrupt classes to announce that I was Martin, Amy's dad. And the collection could take up to an hour, and I didn't mind one little bit. Then, after college, she moved into a shared house with 3 other young women and round-the-clock care. They've just had their 10th anniversary, the same 4 young women from day one, which tells you how lucky we are for her to be there. It's become the centre of her world. She configures herself around it, not me. This is a rite of passage that comes to nearly all parents, the wound we wait for with a mixture of dread and relief. Amy lacked the understanding to make it easy on me. She likes to know where and when she is, to do things on their proper days as per her weekly chart. She chants her chores over and over. A week is something she can hold in her head, and each new chart is comfortingly not very different to last week's. Each new Monday, she wakes up, presses rewind, and goes about her business as usual. Every third or fourth week, I disrupt the pattern by making the 4-hour round-the-clock trip to Collector. She gets anxious when she's away, so we must have our pattern too. Bowling, cinema, big shot, pancakes, pies. Bowling, cinema, big shot, pancakes, pies. We rehearse our routine over and over on the journey. Once we got ourselves into such a pie frenzy that when we got to the big shop, Amy broke free and started charging up to strangers to shout pie at them. We really did become quite the thing. People were seeking us out for the pie experience. And after pies, it's 3 or 4 back-to-back episodes of Casualty. At 8 o'clock, she puts on her best voice and whispers, "Chocolate, Martin, chocolate." And I go and fetch the chocolate. Only one week, distracted by a particularly gruesome episode of Casualty, she forgot. And it became apparent that I'd been conditioned by this as I got more and more anxious as the clock moved towards 9 o'clock. When I just had to give in to my chocolate cravings and remind her. And once we've done all our routine things, then the mithering for the new house intensifies. She still calls it the new house after 10 years. New house, Martin. And when we get there, she doesn't look back. She charges up the stairs to get her stuff about her. I follow on up for my goodbye kiss. My friend Gordon used to write the Scooby-Doo comic, and framed on Amy's walls is the artwork from when he made her the cover story. Amy Figura, the movie star, hiding out for peace and tranquility on K2. She even had her own perfume, Fabulous Figuras. Of course she did. And she accepts this kind of thing as of right, because for her, this is real life too. She steps through that screen every day. For years, she carried a picture of Shaggy around with her, wore it away to a pale green blur held together with sellotape. And as she makes her wonky way through her 30s, the concern is that her anxiety about routine might be a sign of early onset Alzheimer's that can occur in Downs as early as 40. In a few years, she may start to fade to a blur. At some point, she might not remember who I am, and I'll hit rewind again and again. You clutch my forearm, little white bear, a pinch of skin in your fist. The house is tiptoe quiet, the fight surrendered to gripe water and charcoal. I dare not move but for the rise and fall of my belly. I am tethered by a fingertip to the insistent tug of your map, the extra chromosome of your map. You drift away to a house of picture charts with Velcro symbols for household chores and activities. You have your own calendar. You enjoy hoovering and bowling most of all. Every Thursday you must have the same sandwich from Subway or the moon will fall from the sky. I am a smiley face. My days clearly marked. Yet somehow I am ill prepared. One night, I drove across the city in a rainstorm wearing my reading glasses. I was fast approaching 50 and on my own again. The rain on the windscreen was sharp. Beyond that, everything was just a blur. I had to reach for the inspirational poster inside myself to find the courage not to turn back, but to press on into that blur of rain in the hope that I might reach the sunshine, which will arrive any moment. There it is. In Search of Lost Time, Marcel Proust wrote, "When all seems lost, we have knocked at every door and they opened on nothing, until at last we stumble unconsciously against the only one through which we can enter the kingdom." I took this to mean that one day I would walk into a room and there would be the one, which is pretty much what my friend Andrea said at the time. It is just so much more impressive to quote Proust than your friend Andrea. When he was a young boy, the single, reckless Eric's mama told him, "There's only one girl in the world for you, and she probably lives in Tahiti." Eric chose to search the whole wide world to find out where they hide her. In Camera Lucida, one of the pictures is not by a photographer, but by a scientist. For 50 years, Harold D. Edgerton photographed drops of milk to the millionth of a second in the hope of perfection. Just a few days after Andrea spoke to me, a saucy seaside laugh broke through the hubbub of a bar. I looked up and there was Helen Ivory. A few weeks later, I was telling anyone who'd listen, I was going to marry Helen Ivory. We celebrated her birthday in a Paris restaurant, and an old Frenchwoman sent the waiter over to tell us that Helen was beautiful. At that moment, my life seemed like a movie. All its catastrophes, just plot devices. So for this scene, the score could take flight and the credits roll for Happy Ever After. After Roland Barthes' death, they found an unfinished manuscript in his Paris apartment entitled, "One Always Fails to Speak of the Things One Loves." In our first year together, Helen wrote a whole book of love poems about me, or a lovelier version of me, if you can imagine such a thing. When people who'd read the book first met me, well, I rather resent the crashing my joke line, but anyway. When people who'd read the book first met me, I could tell they were disappointed. They were too polite to say anything, of course, but I could see it in their eyes. Well, this guy. And I failed, if not to speak, to write down the words to do justice to the wonder that is Helen Ivory. Nothing for 12 years. Then one time, Harold D. Edgerton fires his flash gun. The moon falls from her starry dynamo into the fifth of seven oceans, the ocean of milk. In the piercing of meniscus, there's a white coronet. For a millionth of a second, the still centre of life. Then there is only the before and the after. The ripples on the surface, the sound waves of laughter. The ferris wheel lifts us high above Paris, the lights of the waltzers spin brightly below. 12 years later, in the Happy Ever After internet shopping, I clicked buy now and declared that I had won Valentine's Day. Helen Ivory suggested that you don't win Valentine's Day, Martin. I told her to not bother even trying. There was nothing she could do. She put the exchange on Facebook and Facebook agreed with her. Then Valentine's Day arrived, and a piece of red plastic, a personalised 3D Viewmaster, had won Valentine's Day. The likes and comments from envious women came pouring in. From their partners, the purchasers of expensive flowers and meals out, not so much. We clicked our way through the careful chosen moments of our past, the punctums and tiny jubilations. We're still thrilled by how new it seems, even after 12 years, so it was unexpected to find a different Martin and Helen there, hovering in front of our eyes in shonky 3D. How wide-eyed and innocent we looked, like goofy teenagers. Amy Figura has never had any problems romanticising her past. In a recent attempt to extend our routine, I paid £10 for us to go to the swimming pool at the gym. Amy began by attempting to climb the wall into an already crowded jacuzzi. This led to a bad-tempered exchange between the two of us, and swimming pools are very echoey places. And now we had everybody's attention, I attempted to walk her down the steps into the shallow end. Now I thought it was pretty warm. Amy strongly disagreed. Cold Martin, stupid Martin, cold Martin. And then she leapt on me and clung like a shouty limpet. She'll get used to it and quieten down, I thought. 2 minutes later, we were back in the dressing room, and home 10 minutes after that. A catastrophe by anybody's standards. Amy burst through the front door. Helen, 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 Amy swimming. Oh, yes, good girl, Amy, well done. Clever girl, Amy swimming. It was the greatest triumph there had ever been. One she reminds me of every time we drive past the gym. Amy has never lost a game of anything in her life. And as far as she knows, she is immortal. I, on the other hand, am 60 this year and find myself looking back from time to time. And I read this in one of those Bukowski books. I have been treated better than I should have been, not by life in general, nor by the machinery of things, but by women. Now, Dawn and I get together once in a while, and whilst we lack Amy's capacity to convert catastrophe into triumph quite so convincingly, we are careful and kind to each other. We're good people. Her doctor told us that once. And we're pleased for each other's new happinesses, and we went through some things together that would break a heart. And we leave those in that box with that picture of Amy and get on with laughing about some of the things we did together. And we laugh hardest of all at the very idea of us as a couple. The us of that curbside embrace that I tried for so many years to rewind to. And it would be easy to look at those now as wasted years. Only what we did during that time, the good thing we did together, was raise the kids. And we'd have lost that if we'd have had the nerve. And Amy, of course, was no catastrophe, but a wonderful gift and a privilege. And as you realise, someone who always steals the show. And Sean, the young man who accompanied me on that road trip, knows it better than anyone. She's done it his whole life, and he has never once complained. He taught me that, and not to be a wanker. Same thing, really. What would be a life without the odd catastrophe, without the slightest shift in the machinery, without the good doctor's wheel doing its little dance just once in a while? Even those perfect families, you know, the ones with their Sunday walks and roast dinners, their beautiful A-star offspring, everyone comfortable in their own skins and with each other's company, you'll be pleased to know they'll have a box of sadnesses too. Everybody does. A life without catastrophe is unimaginable. What would we measure ourselves by? I'm not saying all catastrophes can be got over or kept in a box. Sometimes the damage is irreparable. And there is going to be another catastrophe. We all know that, right? I'm holding out for the big one. You know, death. Specifically mine. Because I don't know how I would cope with all the other catastrophes I can imagine. Amy forgetting who I am. I would never get over that. And the memory of my mother is an elusive sensory one that I struggle to see in those photographs that have been memento mori for 50 years now. Roland Barthes grew up to know his mother when he was an adult. My mother and I never got beyond the narrow confines of a one-way dependency. I never got to meet her when I was an adult. I'd always thought that to be an irretrievable loss because the memory simply doesn't exist. Then, a couple of years ago, I was sitting on the floor in a small front room at a New Year's party where the 1950s were back in fashion. Helen and some of our friends dressed like my parents' generation, but with more style. Suddenly, I had the sense that I was surrounded by my aunts and uncles at a New Year's party I'd been allowed to stay up for, and to be the dark-haired first footer bringing good luck as a piece of coal through the back door at midnight. I had just completely forgotten that this had ever happened, that I had seen my past my bedtime mother laughing and enjoying herself with a drink in her hand. And as the evening wore on and the drinks went down, I drifted between now and then, and I was overwhelmed with contentment. It was a kind of heaven. Each new guest slips from fog and through the door like a softly lit movie star and casts adrift the new-built houses opposite, the call centres, the inner ring road's constant hum, and this little room is warm and bright with party dresses and men with quiffs in baggy suits, and in the bedroom up above where all the faux fur coats are chucked, the radio's clock flicks back and back, and above the roof, above the fog, stars are streaks across the sky, and above all that, beehives glow like standard lamps, and Louis Prima swings, and jokes are spilt, and someone shouts, "Fetch me a blousy woman now," and his wife throws her scarf about his neck, kisses him loose upon the mouth, and from our mouths, "If you knew Susie like I know Susie, oh, 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 what a girl." And in the yard, fog is smoke and smoke is breath, and cigarettes are shooting stars. And through the misted window's blur, is that my mother's gap-toothed grin, my aunts and uncles counting down? And is this me at the back door, a lump of coal grit in my fist?